the secret arms trade between Israel and apartheid South Africa.
Israel essentially got into bed with the apartheid regime very quickly after the Yom Kippur War. Within one month, in fact, Magnus Malan, who was a leading defense official in South Africa at the time and later became the defense minister, came to visit Israel. And that's when the arms trade between the two countries really begins to take off.
That's Sasha Polakow-Saransky. We talk with him about his book, The Unspoken Alliance. And later in the show, we play an excerpt from our 2009 interview with Israeli journalist Amira Haas. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. As we produce this show, the World Cup soccer games in South Africa are over, and a new word has entered the American vocabulary, vuvuzela. But 6 decades ago, a much more sinister word came into our vocabulary from South Africa, apartheid. After decades of struggle, black South Africans were able to overthrow the brutal apartheid regime, an effort that was helped by an international embargo against trade with South Africa. But not all countries observed the embargo, and some that claimed to did not do so in fact. One of them was Israel, and the lucrative trade it carried on with the apartheid regime was in weapons. The relationship extended to high-level sharing of information and supplies for the secret nuclear weapons programs of both countries. That's what my guest, Sasha Polakow-Saransky, shows in his controversial new book, The Unspoken Alliance, Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa. The day before the book was released, The Guardian published a story about top-level secret documents Polakow-Saransky found, revealing that Israel offered to sell nuclear warheads to the apartheid regime. In response, Shimon Peres issued a categorical denial. But the author stands by this and even more damning revelations that he uncovered through painstaking research and face-to-face interviews with key officials involved. Sasha Polakow-Saransky is a senior editor of Foreign Affairs, the Journal of the Council of Foreign Relations in New York. I went to the offices of that august establishment to talk with the author. Sasha Polakow-Saransky, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the material of the book, did you at all feel any pushback or conflict from other Jews that you knew in exploring the story?
Yeah, there was a little bit. I heard about it from friends, some people in my family. I had friends who said, oh, this is interesting, but what do you think the consequences for Israel will be? It will make Israel look bad. And my response to that then and now is that I don't believe in concealing the truth because of some political or nationalist or religious agenda. I don't believe that one should sweep things under the rug, even if it's in my own family. I don't think that that's defensible to hide something as important as this. And so that's what I told my friends then. That's what I tell to members of my family in South Africa who are angry about the book and all the attention that it's received, is that this happened and it's a story worth telling and it's important to tell and it's important to examine. And there's really no reason to suppress historical truth in the interest of defending a state or a nation or anything. And so that's how I've always felt about it. And I think it is a touchy topic and a difficult one for any Jewish person to deal with. But when you grow up as a Jew in South Africa, or in my case as the child of South African Jews who left for political reasons, this is something you're very sensitive to. And for me, growing up, the great moral outrage that we talked about around the dinner table was apartheid and racial discrimination in South Africa. And when you discover that Israel, the country that you're taught to love and admire in your Hebrew school classes, was an instrumental part of supporting that regime, then it raises a lot of questions. And those are questions that I'd always had and that I wanted to answer.
Apartheid in South Africa, I think many people think that it was an eternal institution, but it only came about after World War II. And it seems a very strange alliance that eventually developed between Israel and South Africa, because so many of the people who were involved with bringing apartheid about were actually anti-Semitic themselves.
Yeah, it's a paradox, and to some, a really disgusting irony. My grandparents on my father's side were refugees from Nazi Germany, and they came to South Africa in the 1930s. And for people of their generation, and specifically those who were refugees from Europe, there was real fear in 1948 when the National Party came to power in South Africa, the apartheid regime. You know, they defeated Jan Smuts in the May 1948 election, and just 2 weeks after the State of Israel was established, the apartheid state was established in South Africa. And South Africa wasn't some sort of multiracial paradise before May 1948. It was a colonialist, racist regime, much like what you saw throughout the rest of Africa. But Jan Smuts did campaign against apartheid, against the overt state-sanctioned form of racism and separation that the Afrikaner nationalists and the National Party were pushing during that election. But Smuts lost, the nationalists won, and they institutionalized what came to be known as apartheid, which essentially means separateness or apartness in Afrikaans. And by the early 1950s, this included, you know, unequal education acts, formalized segregation, prohibition of interracial marriage, and various other laws designed to consign black people to the most undesirable, far removed parts of the country and reserve the prime urban territory and most desirable land for whites. And so for Jews in South Africa in those early years, there was a lot of fear, and I argue in the book that the fear was justified. If you had just left Berlin like my grandparents had in 1935, and you come seeking refuge, and suddenly a regime comes to power that had openly supported the Nazis during World War II, you're going to be scared. But what you see in the early 1950s is a sort of patching up between the South African Jewish community and the Afrikaner regime, not least because the Afrikaner nationalists needed every white vote that they could get. They were a minority regime that came to power in an election that excluded over 80% of the population. And there were opposition parties, white opposition parties, and getting some Jews, at least, to support their government was important. And so excluding Jews was not good policy, and it was not good politics. And so by the early 50s, you see Jews essentially become white in South Africa, and the discrimination that they had faced before remained on a personal level and on a neighborhood level, and anti-Semitism never went away in South Africa, but the institutionalized discrimination from the state itself never came to pass. And that's a very crucial distinction, because throughout the 60s and the 70s, the official institutions of the Jewish community in South Africa, the Board of Deputies and the Zionist Federation, were very reluctant to openly condemn apartheid and to openly denounce leading figures in the regime for fear that the Jewish community might be punished as such, and that the government would lead a backlash against the Jews, reviving their latent anti-Semitism that had gone away. And I believe that those fears by the 60s and 70s were unfounded. While they were very valid in the 40s and the early 50s, by that time, international pressure on South Africa and international criticism of South Africa for its treatment of blacks was so great that any state-sanctioned backlash against Jews would have not been tolerated, and the reaction from Washington and London would have been ferocious.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Sasha Polakow-Saransky here at the offices of the Council on Foreign Relations, where he is a senior editor. Israel was founded by socialists in many ways, not exclusively, but people who had not only suffered their own discrimination, but also had held to very strong ideals of social justice. And this led to condemnation in general, round condemnation in the early years of the Israeli state against apartheid. But then that began to change. Tell us when it began to change and why.
It's a gradual process, and it begins in the late 1960s. And the real break and the real realignment occurs in 1973. So what you see throughout the 1960s, as you said, is a strong line against apartheid in South Africa, coming from people like Golda Meir and David Ben-Gurion, the founding pioneering generation of labor Zionists, people who had a real commitment to a moral vision of Israeli foreign policy. Now, that's not to say that they were particularly moral in their treatment of Palestinians. And certainly, if you look at Golda Meir's famous statements about Palestinians not existing as a people, that is a completely different story. But what I'm talking about in this book is Israeli foreign policy toward the outside world and specifically toward Africa. And during the 1960s, there really was a sense of affinity with the newly independent post-colonial African nations. And Golda Meir constantly made comments about this, how she identified with these newly independent nations that were struggling to throw off the colonial yoke. And many of the first generation of Zionists in Israel saw in nations like Ghana and Senegal a similar struggle and sense of achievement. And so throughout the 60s, Israel funded development programs and agricultural programs and even security training programs for the police and armies of these new states. And the relationships were quite close, and Golda Meir went to visit often. Ben-Gurion spoke at the Organization of African Unity meetings. And they constantly denounced apartheid and expressed friendship with these new independent black states. And in the late 60s, especially after the Six-Day War in 1967, a slow realignment begins in Africa. And some of these post-colonial states start to move into the Arab camp. And some of this is due to inducements in terms of cheap oil and offers of financial aid. Some of it is ideological in the sense that many on the left throughout the world, including in Africa, reacted to Israel's victory in the Six-Day War and its occupation of the West Bank and Sinai and the Golan Heights and Gaza by changing their view of Israel, and they began to see Israel as a sort of colonial or imperialist power rather than a small, newly independent state that they could admire. So many of the African states start to move into the Arab camp, and much of that is due to the efforts of Arab countries like Libya and Saudi Arabia and others to lure them to that side. And then in 1973, during the Yom Kippur War, almost all of the African states severed ties with Israel during the war or immediately after it. And Israel felt extremely betrayed by its old allies. And at that precise moment, South Africa was expressing support, offering to send aid, and Israel essentially got into bed with the apartheid regime very quickly after the Yom Kippur War. Within one month, in fact, Magnus Malan, who was a leading defense official in South Africa at the time and later became the defense minister, came to visit Israel and toured the battlefields just a month after the Yom Kippur War ended. And that's when the arms trade between the two countries really begins to take off immediately at the end of 1973, and then really during 1974 and 1975, as Shimon Peres takes over the defense ministry and is put in charge of rebuilding Israel's defense capability, he steps up Israel's exports all over the world, and South Africa quickly becomes the most important customer for the Israeli defense industry and a key source of export earnings for an Israeli economy that was completely ravaged after the war.
So you're saying that this is not only a strategic security alliance, but also a lucrative trade as well, an economic alliance.
Oh, yes. More than anything, at the beginning, it was about money. And the other thing that is worth mentioning and remembering is that there was also an ideological shift within the Labour Party itself during these years, from 67 to 73, 74. And you see the old guard, the Ben-Gurions and the mayors, giving way to a new generation of Labour politicians. And although they're in the same party, people like Peres and Yitzhak Rabin and Moshe Dayan represented a new vision of Israeli foreign policy and a much more technocratic and realist vision of Israel's security dilemma. And they were willing to make moral compromises that their predecessors had not been willing to make. And Peres and Rabin initiated the entire relationship with South Africa. It wasn't the Israeli right. It was the Labour Party that started this. And it certainly intensified later under the Likud Party. But the initial relationship began with Peres and Rabin. And Golda Meir resisted it at first. But by 1974, she was out of power, and this really took off.
And we're talking with Sasha Palachow-Saransky about his book, The Unspoken Alliance: Israel's Secret Relationship with Apartheid South Africa. Now, as you say, this is a relationship. Shimon Peres is the Israeli defense minister. This is a relationship of support and convenience and the exchange of arms trade. Now it also becomes very involved with the development of nuclear weapons. Talk about that. And were, did nuclear weapons become the central focus of this relationship, and if so, why?
They never became the central focus of the relationship, but nuclear technology was always part of it. If you look at the actual money and how much was spent and how much time and effort was put into various programs, it was certainly the conventional weaponry, the aircraft, the tanks, the ammunition, the missiles, etc., that formed the bulk of this relationship. But nuclear technology was important too, but it was a side issue. But obviously, it's the most controversial of all of these transactions. The nuclear discussion that has received the most attention really only takes up about two paragraphs in this book. But the Guardian newspaper in London picked up on it and ran a front page story about it the day before the book came out in the United States, and that story was then picked up in newspapers across the world and led within a few hours to a categorical denial from Shimon Peres that he had been involved in any nuclear discussions with the South Africans and that he had never offered to sell nuclear weapons to the South Africans. Now, the specific allegation in the book is that between March and June 1975, Shimon Peres and other leading Israeli defense officials participated in a series of meetings with the South African defense minister, P.W. Botha, and his underlings in the South African defense ministry. And these meetings took place in South Africa and in Switzerland, and they discussed all sorts of weapon systems. Israel was eager to sell anything and everything at the time. Like I said earlier, the economy was in shambles. Peres had been put in charge of rebuilding the army, but also rebuilding the defense industry. And the defense industry was really one of the only bright spots in Israel at the time. And the Israeli armed forces couldn't buy everything that these companies were producing, and so they needed to look for export markets abroad, and South Africa became a very important one because South Africa was feeling extremely threatened in 1974 and 1975 as the Portuguese pulled out of their African colonies in Angola and Mozambique, and a war starts in Angola, pitting anti-communist forces funded by South Africa and the United States against Russian and Cuban-backed communist forces. so South Africa began arming itself to its teeth during these years, and they referred to the threat on their borders as total onslaught. And so in this context, Israeli arms become very important, and South Africa becomes a very big customer all of a sudden. And so these discussions between Peres and Botha in March and June 1975 focused on all sorts of weapons that the South Africans wanted to buy, but the most controversial of them was the Jericho missile system, which was an Israeli ballistic missile. And the South Africans expressed interest in buying this, provided that it had the appropriate warhead. And the language used in the minutes from these meetings is quite ambiguous, which is typical for defense discussions, especially when anything nuclear is involved. And they talk about the warhead. They talk about the warhead coming in three different sizes. And it's quite unclear at first until you look at some of the accompanying documents that were written the same day and in subsequent days by leading South African defense officials. The chief of staff of the South African Defense Force, writing to his superiors, sends a long memo talking about the Jericho missile system and how it would benefit South Africa, but specifically how it would only be economical and useful for South Africa if armed with a nuclear warhead. And he then discusses how this is very expensive, but that he believes that South Africa should respond positively to the offer despite the high price because it would be beneficial. So what becomes clear from this is that there was a discussion and the South Africans perceived that there was an explicit offer on the table. Whether the offer was a final offer approved at the highest levels in the Israeli government by Prime Minister Rabin is unclear. I personally doubt that Rabin would have approved such an offer, but it is very plausible that Shimon Peres would have discussed such matters and made such an offer because he had a long history of running his own freelance foreign and defense policy and was quite instrumental in helping Israel get its nuclear reactor that later became the Dimona complex where Israel built its nuclear weapons from France in the mid-1950s. And Shimon Peres almost single-handedly managed that defense relationship with France while he was a low-level or mid-level official in the defense ministry. And he went behind the backs of his superiors in order to do it. So it was entirely in character for him to be holding these sorts of discussions as defense minister. So that particular allegation is what received the most attention. It's not the most shocking by any means in the book. There was a great deal of other cooperation in the nuclear sphere. South Africa had been shipping uranium to Israel for years, starting in the early 1960s, in small amounts each year, and it built up into a large stockpile. But until 1976, all of that uranium was placed under safeguards, which meant that the two governments had agreed that it would be used for peaceful and research purposes only. And the South Africans actually went to Israel each year and inspected the uranium to make sure that it wasn't being used for military purposes. But then in 1976, the Israelis requested that South Africa lift the safeguards. And this happened at a very high level. The head of Israel's scientific intelligence establishment approached the Prime Minister of South Africa, John Foster, and his intelligence chief, Hendrik Vandenberg, and said that Israel needed this. And by that time, there was a stockpile of about 500 tons of yellow cake uranium. And the Prime Minister sent his mining minister, Fani Botha, to Israel to facilitate the lifting of the safeguards. And he went to Israel, he met with Peres, he met with Rabin, he met with the leading nuclear officials and leading generals, and he eventually lifted the safeguards, which is something that Fani Botha himself admitted to me in an interview 5 years ago. And it's also corroborated by Israeli Ministry of Defense documents and an in-camera trial record from South Africa that came to light after the transition to democracy, and that documents not only the lifting of the safeguards and this uranium trade, but also the quid pro quo that South Africa received in return, which was a small but important amount of a substance called tritium, which is used in nuclear weapons to boost the explosive power of those weapons. And South Africa received 30 grams of this in return from the Israelis. And the Israelis also were funneling money to the mining minister, Fani Bota, at the time, because Fani Bota was facing personal bankruptcy, and they feared that if that were exposed in the press, it would lead to the end of his political career, and he might lose this key portfolio in the South African cabinet before this entire deal went through. So that, to me, is the more telling and more explosive revelation in the nuclear sphere in this book. But, of course, it's more complicated than saying that Shimon Peres offered nuclear weapons to South Africa in 1975.
What you're really saying here is you have two states that are basically secretly developing nuclear weapons. Why is it more of a shock to you, this revelation, than the willingness to supply intercontinental ballistic ICBMs that can be used to actually deliver these weapons?
The second story to me is more shocking because it actually happened. The first deal never went through. They had these discussions. There was an offer of sorts on the table. The South Africans took it very seriously and considered buying the Jerichos, but eventually they chose not to. So the uranium for tritium deal and the element of international corruption that's involved in it, and the fact that it actually happened and that South Africa lifted safeguards on hundreds of tons of uranium that Israel subsequently used to fuel its nuclear program, and that Israel in return supplied South Africa with something that would later be a crucial ingredient in the more advanced nuclear weapons that it hoped to build in the 1980s but never finished building, is much more of a telling revelation to me. But one thing to mention about the Jericho deal is that even though it didn't go through in 1975, the two countries continued to cooperate on Jericho-based missile systems well into the 80s. And then what happens is that Israel had actually been cooperating with Iran, pre-revolutionary Iran, up to 1979 on missile technology. And after Khomeini comes to power, the relationship functionally ends, and Israel needs a new partner for missile technology. And so they turn again to South Africa, but now rather than offering to sell it, they start a joint research and development program and involved dozens of Israelis going down to South Africa and working on a secret testing range on the south coast between Cape Town and Port Elizabeth in a place called Arniston. And this Overberg test range was really in the middle of nowhere next to a nature reserve facing thousands of miles of open ocean, and it was an ideal place to test long-range weapons. And together, the Israelis and the South Africans worked on building delivery systems for nuclear warheads. And it was an essential program for both countries. It led to a more advanced delivery system for South Africa, but it was also an opportunity for Israel to test weapons that it couldn't test in its neighborhood because there wasn't enough space and it was too conspicuous. But down in South Africa, there was plenty of space and no one was watching except the occasional U.S. or Russian satellite, which when they did pick up these tests got Israel into a lot of trouble.
Israel has all along denied that it has nuclear weapons. The U.S. seems to have been asleep at the wheel for a long time, not really believing what happened. How has this open secret been able to remain such a secret for so long?
Well, the U.S. has known since 1969, if not earlier, officially since 1969, when President Nixon and Prime Minister Golda Meir met and discussed this. By that point, Israel had finished its nuclear weapons. Most people believe that their first weapons were operational during the Six-Day War in 1967. So it is an open secret, and everyone knows. And Israel has never admitted to it because that would require it to join the NPT and become a nuclear state, a respectable nuclear power like the United States or Britain or France, or to become a pariah in the mold of North Korea. And so Israel has always maintained this ambiguous stance, and it did serve Israel's interests for a long time. Now, many would argue that given that Iran is trying to develop nuclear weapons and that there's pressure for a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, that this is no longer a viable strategy. And so we are probably going to see a major debate in the coming months and years over Israel's nuclear status. But historically, they started very early, and it was always a key ambition of Ben-Gurion, and it was well-funded, and Shimon Peres managed to obtain the necessary technology from France in the 50s, and by the mid-1960s, Israel was well along the path to developing nuclear weapons, and they did so by deceiving the United States repeatedly, as the U.S. sent inspectors to look at the Dimona facility, and Israel managed to conceal what was really going on there for long enough to actually cross the finish line, and by that point, the U.S. essentially had to accept it as a fait accompli.
Sasha Polakow-Saransky. We'll talk more after a break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Sasha Polakow-Saransky about his controversial new book, The Unspoken Alliance. It's about Israel's secret relationship with apartheid South Africa. It carried on an arms trade and shared information that aided both countries' nuclear weapons programs. Now, there was a certain point at which Israel, in a way, blackmailed the United States around the Yom Kippur War, threatened to use nuclear weapons. Tell us about that. What happened?
Well, it's an episode that no one really knows the truth about. There's been a lot written on it, a lot of speculation, but the key players have never come forth and said what actually happened. Henry Kissinger could give you the answer. I can't give a definitive answer, but what did happen is, in the early days of the Yom Kippur War, Israel faced massive casualties and losses and demanded or repeatedly requested a massive airlift of weaponry from the United States. And during the first few days of the war, Nixon and Kissinger refused. And as the situation grew more serious, some believe that Israel openly threatened to use its nuclear arsenal, and that that prompted the U.S. resupply, the U.S. airlift of a huge amount of weaponry in mid-October 1973, that was very helpful to the Israelis. What actually happened is probably less blackmail than a subtle suggestion that this might happen. Israel had nuclear weapons by this point. The U.S. was well aware of it. The Soviets were well aware of it. And Israel's antagonists in the war, Egypt and Syria, were aware. And most of the academic literature on this suggests that Israel signaled in subtle but very noticeable ways that it was deploying and readying its nuclear arsenals. And that sort of signal to intelligence satellites and defense experts can be very subtle and still have the desired effect. It can simply mean moving launchers out or a convoy of trucks going from a facility where nuclear weapons are known to be stored. And so that is likely what happened in 1973, and it was a strong enough signal that Israel was moving to a higher state of alert And even if there wasn't an overt threat in a meeting between the Israeli ambassador and Kissinger, as some people believe, there was a signal, and it was enough to prompt the U.S. To get involved.
Now, over time, the South African apartheid regime was subject to an embargo that eventually succeeded in helping the regime to end. Israel did not participate in the embargo at first, and then did. There's a kind of murky relationship there, an ambivalent one. Tell us what happened, and also, if you could, tell us what was the impact of Israel's relationship with South Africa at that time in terms of its own standing in the world.
Israel always violated the embargo throughout the late 70s and early 1980s, and quite openly. Obviously, most of the transactions were very secretive, and so only here and there did people notice that something was being sold or shipped. And journalists picked up on this occasionally, they just didn't have the whole picture. But by the mid-1980s, a lot of journalists, including people like Thomas Friedman, were writing about this relationship and saying that there was a multi-million-dollar annual weapons trade. But again, it wasn't based on official documentation or interviews with key officials. So people had an idea of what was going on. And yes, Israel violated the embargo. And after other countries began to observe it, countries like the U.S. and France and other European nations, Israel became a real lifeline to South Africa in the 80s. And it wasn't until 1987 that Israel began to symbolically observe the embargo. But even then, they pledged not to sign any new arms contracts with South Africa, but they continued to exhaust existing ones. And so in 1988 and 89, despite Israel's sanctions, the trade actually peaks because all of the existing contracts need to be finished up. And so Israel seeks to sell as much as it can before the U.S. really cracks down. And what happened is, in 1989, the administration of George H.W. Bush got angry with the Israeli government because U.S. satellites picked up these missile tests off of the south coast of South Africa. And the Bush administration said, you know, this is 2 years after you imposed sanctions. And Israel imposed sanctions in reaction to the U.S.'s decision to impose sanctions against South Africa. And now, 2 years later, this was still going on. And so that's when the relationship really begins to shut down, as in 89 and 1990. And even though it continues until Mandela is inaugurated in 1994, it starts to trail off in the early 90s.
A lot of people increasingly are beginning to draw parallels between Israel's the occupation of Palestine, Israel's policy towards the Palestinians, and the apartheid regime in South Africa. Former President Carter has his book, Palestine, Peace Not Apartheid. You have a more nuanced discussion of this in the book. What are the parallels that you see between apartheid in South Africa and apartheid-like things happening in Israel and Palestine? And then tell us why you think it's not quite there yet.
Anyone who spent time in South Africa prior to 1994 and who has spent time in the West Bank recently will notice a number of similarities in terms of how movement of people is controlled, how difficult it is for Palestinians to move around the West Bank through checkpoints, identification checks, things that occurred in the old South Africa. Also, access to land, facilities, all these sorts of things, a sort of two-tiered system. In Israel, you have Israeli-only access roads cutting across the West Bank. In South Africa, they never had that, but they certainly had various other separate and unequal facilities and beaches and such. So there are similarities in terms of the control of movement and identification checks and these sorts of things. There are also differences in the sense that the Israeli economy today is not nearly as dependent on Palestinian labor as South Africa was on black labor back in the apartheid days. I mean, the apartheid regime in South Africa, the state itself, the society, white South Africa, couldn't function without the exploitation of cheap black labor and in massive numbers. And so that is an important distinction. Israel imports guest workers from other countries. South Africa also had many migrant workers, but the number of blacks working in the mines, working in people's homes in South Africa was very different. And so the way that the two societies are constructed on a basic economic level is quite different. And I think it's important to recognize that. And so the argument that I make is that the crucial tipping point towards apartheid, political apartheid, is when a minority governs over a disenfranchised majority. And you had that very explicitly in South Africa, obviously, because blacks and Indians and coloreds, mixed race people in South Africa were excluded from the political system. In Israel and Palestine, it's somewhat different. There is an ambiguous situation. Palestinians in Gaza have elected Hamas. Palestinians in the West Bank have elected a PA government. Israelis have elected Benjamin Netanyahu. And you have separate political entities in Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. Obviously, there is not an independent Palestinian state yet. But Israel has never annexed the occupied territories, and that's a debate that has been going on for decades. And one of the primary arguments in Israel against annexation and formally making the West Bank and Gaza part of the Israeli state is that it would tip the demographic balance and make Jews a minority within the territories they control, which is the primary reason why Israel has never formally annexed and taken control of those territories. And so what you have instead is nominal Israeli military control of most of the West Bank. And since Israel withdrew from Gaza, there's no longer formal Israeli control and settlement in Gaza. But obviously, the military has gone back in with devastating force when it decided to. And so the situation of formal political apartheid and a formal situation in which a minority is governing over a majority population doesn't exist for this reason. And several leading Israelis have talked about this. It's not just me, and they've essentially said the same thing that Jimmy Carter said. They just didn't take the same amount of flack for it. But Ehud Olmert said that if Israel didn't get out of the West Bank, they'd face a South African-style struggle back in 2007. Ehud Barak said just a few months ago that if there was only one political entity between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and the Palestinians vote, then it's a binational state, and if they don't vote, then it's an apartheid state. And he actually used the word. And so this is the situation that I believe Israel is moving toward if it doesn't relinquish its control of most of the West Bank and create a viable Palestinian state there. But it's not there yet, on my definition of what political apartheid is.
We're talking with Sasha Polakow-Suransky about his book, The Unspoken Alliance. I wonder, though, how crucial that distinction you make is, let's say, between, you know, the small minority ruling politically over the large majority. I mean, in South Africa, of course, the whole purpose of apartheid was to maintain the cheap labor supply that could support the luxurious lifestyle of the small white minority, whereas the purpose of keeping Palestinians under control and to punish them when they do things like elect leaders like Hamas is to make sure that Israel can, in its own eyes, maintain its own security. So there is that security argument. I wonder if you could actually address that argument of security. How much do you think this policy actually helps or hurts Israel's security?
I think it hurts it in the long run. And I think that even Israel's defense minister has recognized that. And I quoted Ehud Barak a minute ago. I mean, this is deeply, deeply dangerous for Israel's long-term security, because if it doesn't get out of the West Bank, it is going to move decisively in the direction of a political situation that cannot be described as anything but apartheid. And when that occurs, then the label is going to stick, because there are lots of groups now that would like to pin the apartheid label on Israel. I believe that it's premature and that it's not there yet for the reasons I've described. But when it gets to that point, if Israel doesn't get out of the West Bank and there is no Palestinian state, and especially if the Palestinian leadership decides to turn towards a one-state solution rather than a two-state solution and demand civil rights within Israel, then Israel is going to face the South African-style struggle that Ehud Olmert feared, and they are going to get hit with the apartheid label from all corners, not just from left-wing activist groups. And that's an incredibly dangerous situation for Israel, and I think that anyone that cares about the future of Israel and the preservation of Israel as a Jewish state should be very worried about that. But the policies that you see today coming from the Netanyahu administration seem to be pushing in the other direction.
You just mentioned the Netanyahu administration. There's a very fascinating discussion in your book of the rise of the Israeli right. This relationship with South Africa seems to have gone hand in hand with that rise, even though it may have originated in the Labor Party. Could you talk about the position of the Israeli right now, the Israeli right wing now?
Well, the relationship began under Labor officials, Peres and Rabin, but it grew more intimate and more lucrative when Likud came to power in 1977. And there was also more than a simply economic motivation after 1977. And what you see in the late 70s and throughout the 80s in some quarters of the Israeli government, especially in the military establishment and certain key Likud party officials, is a sense of affinity with the South Africans, not necessarily an admiration for their racism per se, but an understanding of their political project, an understanding of their rationalizations for apartheid, because the Israeli right and some Israelis in the military establishment saw themselves facing a common struggle and saw South Africa's struggle to maintain a white minority regime in a region dominated by blacks who oppose them as similar to Israel's struggle in a predominantly Arab region. And they really saw each other as sort of bulwarks against the barbarian hordes at the gates. And the letters that these guys wrote back and forth to each other, you know, Ariel Sharon was writing to Magnus Milan, and Constant Viljoen and Raphael Eitan were writing back and forth to each other, and they were expressing admiration for various operations that they were conducting against their enemies. And so there was a real sense of a common struggle. And of course, people on the Israeli left denounced the relationship and denounced some of these figures. But there was a certain segment of the Israeli government that supported this and was willing to defend apartheid up until the final days and argued that one man, one vote would be the end of the whites in South Africa. And so, you know, some of these people who come out of that same tradition, the revisionist school of Zionism, which is a more militant school and a more nationalist school of the Zionist movement, in contrast to sort of the old socialist labor Zionists who like Ben-Gurion and Meir, these people are at the helm in Israel today. I mean, Netanyahu comes out of that tradition. And the emphasis on the use of force is something that goes back to Begin in the late 1970s, but even further to the founders of revisionist Zionism, to Vladimir Jabotinsky and his followers. And so the current Israeli government is still inspired by that vision. And I would argue that it's not serving Israel's long-term interests to seek to solve every problem with brute force.
Sasha Polakow-Sarensky, your fascinating book is The Unspoken Alliance. I want to thank you very much for taking the time to talk with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sasha Polakow-Sarensky is a senior editor at Foreign Affairs. His writing has appeared in The American Prospect, The International Herald Tribune, The New Republic, and Newsweek. You can read an excerpt from his book, The Unspoken Alliance, at writersvoice.net. Next up, Amira Haas. I spoke with Israeli journalist Amira Haas back in November of 2009. She was visiting the U.S. on a tour to promote her mother's diary of internment in Bergen-Belsen during World War II, which Haas edited. Both her parents were Holocaust survivors. After the war, they emigrated to Israel. Haas says the suffering her parents experienced during the Holocaust made them very vulnerable to any suffering and very attentive to the suffering of the Palestinians. They both became active in the Israeli peace movement. In this excerpt from our 2009 interview, Haas says her mother felt deeply betrayed by what she saw as the use of the Holocaust by Israeli authorities to attack those who criticized their policy toward Palestinians. Her mother referred to it as, quote, the merchandising of the Holocaust, and called for it to stop.
When my mother used and my father used this term, they meant it was in 82 when Arafat was compared to Hitler. It's not only this portrayal of a leader and the people that Israel is pressing, the Palestinian people, but it's also kind of denial of the Holocaust, because if you compare Arafat and the Palestinians to the Nazis, then you really belittle the Holocaust to a frightening degree level. So it's manipulating the ignorance of people of what the Holocaust was, which was an industry of murder, a planned industry of murder. And this is the uniqueness of the Nazi system. So, of course, they used the Holocaust and they used the name of the memory of our families, murdered families, in order to justify occupation, in order to justify colonization of the territories, in order to justify attacks, military attacks such as was against Gaza. And this is so disturbing. It hurts the memory of our families, and it makes the history, it makes the history into cheap merchandise.
Your mother, as having gone through the horrendous experience of Bergen-Belsen, suffered extreme deprivation, starvation, sick with typhus. I mean, she really barely survived. She was a skeleton, practically, at the end of the war. She told you some of her experience. Your father also was a survivor of the camps. He was in Auschwitz, is that
right? No, he was in a ghetto.
But he was also a survivor of terrible deprivation during the war. And he didn't tell you much at all. Going over your mother's diary after her death, and within the context, actually, of your own reporting, of your own experience now, I mean, it seems very much that this is, in some way, a meditation. Your own writing in this diary, you write the foreword and the afterword, is a meditation on comparing these two oppressions, the oppressions of the Jews during World War II, and maybe not comparing the oppressions, but seeing it through the lens of what's going on now. Could you talk a little bit about that, that lens that you shine on it in the light of your own work?
Yeah. Parallels and comparisons, they come up by themselves because it's us, because that's, as my father used to say, I've been through fascism and Nazism, I was not in South Africa. So he makes comparisons. He knows it's not the same. I mean, it's not at all. It's not the same regime. But that's when we analyze the motivations of the regime. And one should not forget, again, and this was industrial manufacturing of death. This was the aim of the German regime. While the Israeli occupation is not about the end product, the planned product is, of course, not murder. It's a combination of colonial regime and apartheid regime, but there is also democracy mainly for Jews, and it's very different. But when we speak about suffering, I think this is what I with the time I realize more. Their experience, my parents' experience, made them very vulnerable to any suffering, very attentive to the suffering of the Palestinians. Even my father once told me, he said, okay, with us it was 5 years and over. It was terrible, it was murder, it was death, and it was over. But with the Palestinians, it goes on. The suffering goes on all the time. So, okay, suffering which does not necessarily bring mass death, but it's suffering. It's people deprived of so many basic things in life, not just its land, its independence, its state, but it's also the freedom of movement. It's the decision to study or to work, where to go, whom to marry. They're deprived of so many things. And this is about this unjust suffering that is caused in order to maintain the privileges of another people. And this was really very repulsive for both my parents, as it is for me and many other Israelis.
The Goldstone report came out, which detailed the suffering of the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelis in the last incursion into Gaza. Mm-hmm. It also talked about crimes that were committed on both sides, but it clearly shows that in terms of the scale and the extent of the destruction, that more was visited upon the Palestinians than vice versa. Do you feel that the tide is beginning to turn? I mean, Goldstone is Jewish. You are Jewish. Parenthetically, I am as well. In the Jewish community itself, do you feel that there's beginning to turn a tide to a greater recognition of the need for fairness?
I want to hope so. It's important to remember that the onslaught on Gaza was possible because of a certain policy of 20 years, which actually disconnected Gaza from the West Bank, from the attention of Israelis, and made Gazans into an abstract enemy that one related to only either as a target of Israeli humanitarian actions, like allowing to pass to Gaza some food or medicine, or as the monstrous abstract of a terrorist which launches rockets. This was very different 20 years before, I mean, up to 1991. Gazans were real people for most of the Israelis. So this onslaught where Israel could do things that give a completely different version about it without many soldiers really to contest the reality, this is not something which came out of nothing. It has its history. So I think that there are Israelis who knew that already before the onslaught and were against the onslaught. There were voices that were hushed in the States, I think, more than they were heard in Israel. I was in J Street, my impression was that people still do not dare to tackle the onslaught itself in public. I'm sure that in closed meetings they did. But I think that this is one of the great achievements of the report, Goldstone's report, is to force a debate, both in Israel and both in among American Jewry and other parts of the world, not necessarily Jews, because all the media talk about it forced a debate which Israel hoped not to have. And this is by itself an achievement.
Israeli journalist Amira Haas, speaking to Writer's Voice in 2009 about the book she edited, Diary of Bergen-Belsen. Haas received the International Women's Media Foundation 2009 Lifetime Achievement Award for her work reporting on Gaza, where she lives. You can hear the entire interview by going to writersvoice.net. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Just search on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.